This podcast is made possible by the generosity of supporting members. Please visit dharmaocean.org to learn more about becoming a supporting member. You are listening to the Dharma Ocean Podcast. Meditating with the body is a course of practice and study that helps modern people reconnect with the reality, goodness, and health of our basic human situation, grounded in our bodies. In today's episode, we'll listen to excerpts from four talks on the view of meditating with the body. These excerpts are taken from talks given at Winter Datun and Meditating with the Body retreats held in Crestone, Colorado.
When we work with the body in the same way as when we work with meditation practice in general, it's very important to have a correct view of what we're doing and why we're doing it. So I want to talk once again a little bit about the view of working with the body in meditation practice. When we are meditating, our goal is not to attain a particular state of mind. Even though when we sit down, we always have some idea of what we're looking for, and usually it's a state of peace and rest. But the actual process of meditation is making a relationship with our experience as it arises in the practice. And therefore, it's very unpredictable. We really never know what's going to happen. And the body plays a very important role in this. Depending on how we work with the body, we could be trying to cultivate some kind of ideal state, which is known as spiritual materialism. In other words, trying to develop some further home for ourselves, some further security. Or we could surrender to the process of meditation itself. And it has very much to do with how we work with our body, which way we go. If we approach our practice and we take our posture in a rigid way and we're looking for some kind of static, immovable posture of meditation, we're encouraging a mind that is going to be dead and frozen and stuck, basically. So I know that a lot of times we have a feeling that when we sit down, we just want to kind of get into the right posture and then meditate. But that approach is actually going to deaden our meditation practice. The other approach is, the one we've been working with here, is that we begin to assume our posture as a result of exploring our own inner physical space. We explore our own inner physical space and we get to know what is actually going on in our bodies. Now, in this culture, when you speak that way, people go, you know, explore your own inner physical space, and they think, whoa, you know, that's heavy. But in, you know, throughout the Buddhist tradition, throughout its entire history, you know, people will tell you, well, of course that's what you do. You have to begin by taking your seat and finding your energetic center and knowing your body, exploring it and discovering it. That's the whole process. And when you do it in that way, then what happens is, as we've talked about, all of the karma that is locked in our bodies begins to loosen and begins to come to the surface. As I mentioned the other day, when Freud did his work at the end of the 19th century and early 20th century, he began to realize that human growth can only happen, human development can only happen when the ego, and this was a term that he coined, begins to relinquish its hold and begins to admit into the field of awareness a lot of things that it didn't want to see. And he, and later psychologists, conceived of this as, they called it, the unconscious. And they thought of it as a dimension of the mind. And it was basically up here. And as I mentioned the other night, it's now very widely believed that all of the memories and experiences and painful and pleasurable things that have happened to us in our lives actually reside in the tissues of our body. And that's where the unconscious is. It's actually in our tissues. It's in our muscles. It's in our tendons. And it's in our bones. And in order to make the journey of meditation, we need to begin to unlock the body. We need to begin to unlock the secrets of the body. Every time that we turn away from a painful experience, our awareness shuts down more. Every time we, in meditation practice, we find that part of our body where that particular painful memory is stored in the form of tension and holding on, and we bring awareness into it, we breathe into it, and we begin to open it up, and that painful memory comes to consciousness, and we live through it, which is what we do on the cushion. You know, we're constantly living through all kinds of things that arise in our practice. Then our awareness, it's almost like you're putting fuel into a fire, and the fire burns brighter. Our awareness burns brighter. In the Tibetan traditions, they actually have a whole series of techniques, which I mentioned, called the Six Yogas of Naropa, which are specifically designed to open the inner recesses of the body and bring, in a very rapid way, bring karma that is unripened to the surface so it can ripen. And what they say is, actually, if you are a practitioner and you've been practicing for a long time doing shamatha vipassana and you feel stuck, you feel like somehow you can't, something isn't really working there. This is the practice that you do. You go back to your body and you start breathing into different areas of your body in a certain way, releasing the areas of holding. It brings relaxation, but it also brings the surfacing of all kinds of karma. Physical karma in the forms of sickness and disease, psychological karma in the form of memories and very strong feelings and sort of seeing the world in a much more naked way, and so on. In the Western Buddhist tradition, we haven't really worked with the body very much, and yet we need to, because more than any Buddhist culture that has ever existed, the body has become a repository of most of our awareness. And if we don't work with our body, we can only get so far. When you are working with meditation, you have to go to the place where the secrets are hidden and where the pain is buried and where the awareness is shut down. And for us, it's the body. So that's the basic view, and that's why we need to really learn how to do this work. And what I've noticed is that people who work with their bodies in the way that we're doing it here, things are much less likely to get stuck. And when they get stuck, they don't get stuck for as long. You know, the movement keeps going, and you don't find people sort of in a frozen state. So today we're going to go a little bit further with the body work, and I wanted to just review the basic principles that we're dealing with here, since they're not written down anywhere, you know, one place. I'm going to go over them every time we do this, just to implant them in your point of view. There's a Tibetan saying that I mentioned the first time we did this, which is that when the body is straight, the channels are straight. The channels meaning the interior pathways that our energy and our awareness travels on, called the nadis. So when the body is straight, the nadis are straight. And when the nadis are straight, the prana is straight, which means the prana means our energy of our awareness. And when the prana is straight, then the mind is open and free. So what's being said there is that the reason that we work with our posture and work with our general sense of the physical dimension of meditation is that the way we hold ourselves physically and the quality of our awareness are inseparably linked. And if you only work with your posture, which is not really what we're doing here, you know, posture here becomes, it's a sort of prelude to other practices, but if you only work with your posture, over time you will, if you work with it in the right way, you will release your places of holding on and unconsciousness, and your awareness will actually gradually develop. So it's a, you know, that's why it's so critical. The other point that we've been talking about is that our discursiveness is also a direct reflection of the extent to which we are unconscious of our bodies. The more unconscious we are of our bodies, the more discursive we will become. And discursiveness doesn't only refer to thinking, when we're thinking a lot of thoughts. It also refers to a concept we might have about meditation, some concept or image we're holding in our head about what we're trying to achieve in meditation. That's also being discursive. That's a discursive thought. And you can have a very long discursive thought. You can have one that lasts. If you happen to be a person who goes in the mountains and meditates and does extreme shamatha, you can actually go into a discursive thought about meditation for 100 years. So that's the product of being unconscious of the body, is that we are basically lost in our mind. And even though we think we're meditating, we're not meditating, we're thinking. And we are gone, and there's no path, there's no progress, and no karma is ripening. So we must be in our bodies as meditators. We must not only be in our bodies, but we must be working with our bodies, which means that we're attentive to the constant movement and flow and flux that goes on when we're in sitting. Really, sitting practice is a physical discipline. That's what we're working with. And as we've talked about, as we work with our bodies, we are releasing tension and we're releasing pockets of holding. And when we do that, our bodies become more peaceful. And as our bodies become peaceful, our minds become peaceful. When our bodies are tense and struggling against themselves, then our discursiveness and our kind of being trapped in the cycle of unawareness is perpetuated. So we could, you know, make headway simply by sitting. And when we sit for a long time, there's a lot of pain that comes up in our sitting practice, which calls us back to our bodies. And that is a way, a very powerful way, actually, of making this journey. You know, our pain, our colds, our sickness calls us back to our bodies. And when we're in our bodies working with those things, which, you know, when we're feeling bad, we really have no choice, the journey occurs. But it's a much more efficacious if we devote a certain amount of our practice time to directly working with our bodies in the way that we've been doing here.
So I want to work with you a little bit on what we call shamatha. How many people have heard of shamatha, which is mindfulness practice? I'm going to explain, so it doesn't really matter if you have or haven't. Often, when you are taught meditation, you are taught what is called shamatha, which means making peaceful. And the technique that is often taught is paying attention to the breath at the tip of the nose. And most commonly, it's the technique that I showed you the other day, which is simply breathing in and breathing out and holding your attention on the physical sensation of the breath. Isn't that true? Many people have been taught that. But what you have to realize is that the technique of following the breath is actually one instance of a much more general category of practice, meaning that the purpose of paying attention to the breath at the tip of the nose is to help ourselves be more present. And we are, in fact, using the body to be more present because the breath is an aspect of our physical life. But you can also use other objects in your body in order to practice mindfulness, such as breathing into the perineum is a shamatha technique because you are paying attention to the perineum, you're holding your attention there, and you are visualizing the breath coming in and out. You can actually feel it, as I was saying yesterday. When you do it fully, you can actually feel the coolness of the oxygenation, you know, that's going on there. So then you could say, well, does it really matter what I pay attention to? And actually, it does matter. You know, the basic principle is very important, which is taking some aspect of your body, and sometimes you can actually take something outside yourself, you know, to pay attention to. But the whole principle of mindfulness is extremely important in meditation. We have to learn how to come out of our thought process and pay attention to some physical aspect of our life. So that principle is very important, but also important is what you pay attention to. Now, the thing about paying attention to the breath at the tip of the nose, that becomes a problem for people who tend to be disembodied because, you know, as Western people, we're already up in our head most of the time. And when your object of mindfulness is also up in your head, you know, you can actually carry out the practice without being embodied at all. And this is not good. This is not helpful. Nothing really happens, as I was saying the other day. However, if you do practice mindfulness of breathing when you are embodied, such as after you've done a certain amount of body work, then it's very fruitful, and it's an embodied practice. So what I teach my students, and I'm teaching you in this program, is we need to begin to fully inhabit our body. And fully inhabit means that when we do meditation practice, there is a sense that the awareness pervades the body, that we are fully aware of our body, we're present. Then we can do following the breath at the tip of the nose, and it's actually very helpful and becomes a gateway to a lot of other things. So I wanted to clarify that relationship and also explain to you why we're not really focusing on that technique. However, what I want to do with you this morning is I want to have us do a little bit of body work and then work with the shamatha technique. And I have two reasons for doing that. One is I'd simply want you to see what it feels like to follow the breath at the tip of the nose after you've done body work and you're really present physically. But the other thing is when we go through the next 4 months, there's going to be a certain protocol that we're going to follow in the meditation exercises, which is you'll have an hour of practice a day, roughly. If you've looked, I don't know, those books haven't been handed out yet, have they? When the books are handed out, the workbooks, you'll see. Roughly an hour, a little bit more sometimes. 10 minutes will be the shamatha technique of following the breath at the tip of the nose, which we're going to work on a little bit between now and when we conclude tomorrow. Then you'll have about a 40, maybe to 45-minute body work guided meditation that you'll do. And then you'll come back to the shamatha practice. So I want you to understand that these are working together. It's not that the body work replaces the shamatha, but it actually provides a training within which we can do shamatha in a fruitful way, the breath at the tip of the nose. Now, you might say, will I always be doing some kind of breath at the tip of the nose meditation in my own practice? And that really depends. If you tend to be a person whose energy rises, you know, some people's energy just rises up. People who are, you know, they have a lot of the wind element, a lot of the space element. They're kind of coming up all the time. For them, sometimes I actually instruct them to use the perineum as their permanent focus of shamatha. So there's really, you know, you sit down and when you do your 10 minutes of shamatha, you're actually breathing into the perineum during that 10 minutes. And then you do your body work and then you come back to the perineum. That can be very beneficial and very useful for some people, and it really changes their practice dramatically. On the other hand, if you're a person who tends to sink, you know what I'm talking about, sinking down and kind of tendency towards darkness and kind of going to sleep and being a little bit depressed, then the breath at the tip of the nose brings your energy up. So what I'm getting to is that the focus of your shamatha, even though everybody in many of the traditions is taught pay attention to the breath at the tip of the nose, that's not always the most effective way to do it. And I would say that the particular shamatha that you're going to do in an ongoing way, you should work that out with your meditation instructor, your mentor, and see, you know, what is most effective. And really the only way to find out is to do it and see if this helps you. If you do breath at the tip of the nose and you tend to find yourself becoming very discursive and you're kind of very heady and kind of up, then that's an indication that that's maybe not the best technique as far as your basic meditation practice is concerned. So I just leave that up to you. But when you do Vajrayana practice, which is the culmination or sort of the higher training in the practice lineage, you actually work with all these different things. And, you know, you work with the perineum, you work with the lower belly, you work with the internal channel, you work with breath at the tip of the nose, you work with space, you work with emptiness. You know, all of these are different things that you do. And eventually, in the long term, the ideal is that all of us have facility in all the different kinds of meditation that are done in the tradition. We know how to enter them, we know how to practice them, and and each one has a kind of different way in which they open our mind. So I'm just mentioning that as a sort of long-term situation, that no matter what we do, actually in the long term, it's going to be part of our repertoire of practices that we'll do and have available. The spiritual journey is a process of developing trust in life, trust in everything that life is. Because until we develop trust, we can't relate to the unknown. As I was saying last night, all of us have this little arena of consciousness, this little protected world that we're constantly trying to fortify of me and my life. And we're trying to do this in the midst of a lot of a huge world. And unfortunately, that little me is starving to death spiritually. We need to open. But the things you can't open unless there's some kind of trust developed. This is where the body work comes in and where it's so important. Because what we're doing is we're actually starting with our body and beginning today, I'm going to be asking you to use a different kind of intelligence than the one that most of us here normally operate with. It's an intelligence of seeing rather than thinking, and of feeling rather than conceptualizing, and of sensing, intuiting. We're going to be working with those tools with our body. And through doing that, hopefully we will begin to develop trust in the unknown, because truly the body is the unknown. We may think we know our body, we don't know our body. You can't know your body, your true body. All of us have a kind of image of what our body is, an idea, a concept, but that's not our body. Our body lives outside the realm of our conscious awareness. It is truly the other. And when you have an other, you only have two choices. One is don't relate to it, which means you can ignore it, you can try to kill it. A lot of people try to kill their bodies through a lot of things. You can try to control the other. Otherness is a fundamental threat to our immediate and personal purchase on the world, our holding on for dear life to this little me. Otherness is a threat to that. If you believe in original sin, then you can say, well, the other is the devil. And that's what we see in fundamentalist Christianity. Anything that is other is the devil. It's pretty straightforward. And we must destroy it, whether it's Iraq or whatever it may be. We must destroy it. Children, they must be, the devil has to be beaten out of them. What that means is, you know, in fundamentalist sort of kind of child-rearing techniques, we have to beat the otherness out of the child so that, any kind of sense of otherness that's in the child needs to be eliminated. So that is one approach, and it's an approach a lot of people take. The other approach is to realize that only in otherness is there any hope of anything whatsoever, of any growth, of any love, of any genuine learning, and so on. When we approach the body through the work, hopefully, we will begin to see and sense the richness of darkness, the richness of what cannot be thought about, but what can be felt, the nourishing quality of what is in the shadows. And through working in that way, I do believe, and I've found, we will be able to begin to appreciate something much more vast than the simple limited body that we have right here. Or maybe what we'll do is discover that our body is actually unlimited and that there are vistas and worlds that we've never imagined within our body.
To find out more about the next Meditating with the Body retreat that begins in September, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Ketchog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.